if I'm going to be there and it's not going to be over tomorrow, I have to adjust myself to it. And I also found out that I don't take power, you know, to be a good soldier. It takes brains, it takes good health, definitely good health, you know, which I had at that time. And I tried to do things the best way I understood. And somehow they recognized it. It did not go unnoticed. Yeah. When I had to do something, they knew it's in good hands. It will be done, it will be done right. When I was given an assignment or a detail, so they expected it should be good and so on. And I tried my best to do it. So I personally did not encounter, but I will not say that I wasn't any. I have seen other Jewish soldiers who did have problems. And the problems, if I tried to evaluate it, was a little bit self-inflicted.
What do you mean? How do you mean?
And I'll explain what self-inflicted was. Yes. We had a fellow from, I usually was the only Jew among 100 men, sometimes two, and never more than three. Never more. If he came from New York, they were braggers. Among the 100 men, they were 50% of them from Kentucky and from Texas and from Oklahoma. They were all from the Southwest or Southerners from Virginia. And when a New Yorker started to brag about all the convenient things he had in New York, you know, and the kind of bedroom he had and the kind of shoes he wore, and you probably wear shoes for the first time. In other words, they were bragging about themselves, which was distasteful to them. I didn't have that. I asked one time, one officer, and he was a Texan, how do you know? I said, how do you size up a soldier and you know who is a Jew? He says, I know. I say, how? He says, very easy. He says, I'm a Jew in Dallas. In Fort Worth, he was from that area. He was a first lieutenant, a young man. He says, by mannerism, how they...
What does that mean?
The way they act. Mannerism, he says. The way they speak. Not the accent or language, the way they speak. He says, that's the way I size them up. And me, he never says that to me.
Yeah, I was just going to say, did he know you were Jewish?
No, he didn't.
Interesting.
He didn't know. That was before the other incident. He did not know. I just asked him. See, I knew he had a few warnings called down the other fellow from Philadelphia.
What
Lina.
Do you think he meant by that?
By mannerism, he meant the way you speak and the way you act. He says there's something there, a special mannerism about Jewish people. He says that I somehow detect it, I feel it.
Except he didn't detect it in you.
Didn't detect it in me. And most of them, when I had a new captain after, became a very good friend of mine. And little by little, I found out that he was very much inclined for Ku Klux Klan. Very much inclined. Because I seen some of literature that he used to get, and I used to write with him in an armored car. And he would share with me anything he had. He had a bartender, give me the half.
Did he know you were Jewish?
Not at the beginning, but in time he knew. But he did not change in any way. In any way, you know, he said, you're the best I have here. Wherever I go, you go. And that was the truth.
Mm-hmm.
Whenever I was on a list to be transferred, every soldier has an MOS, a military specialty. When we came to Hawaii, and some units lose a man through sickness or an accident in training or something. Mm-hmm. And they needed a man like me with another outfit to be moved up. You have to be dead in Hawaii 6 months training for landings on the island before you shift forward. And I was many a time on the list. They'd come in a hurry with a note, you know, get packed up and you're going to go. He says, don't pack and don't go. He says, I'm going to battalion headquarters and you're going anywhere else. The only time you go is where I go. So he did not rub off on me, but he had that inclination to be like a Catholic, you know, if you knew he was a Catholic, you know, Catholic holiday or so. He But he did not take it personal, and he thought if the Jews are no good. But eventually I got to talk to him about it, and he admitted that in his family they are Ku Klux Klan, they're against Jews and Catholics. And I asked him why. By that time he knew that I was Jewish. And he says, I say, Captain, I say, you're making a mistake. I say, there are bad Jews, and there are good Jews, there are good Christians and bad Christians among all people. But basically, Jewish are good people. I said, but that doesn't mean you won't find a bad egg. And the reason was that his grandfather was cheated by a Jew.
Mm-hmm.
He was a peddler, and sold them. They were farmers. He was an engineer himself. He was a mining engineer. He was a National Guard officer, and he was a good man. He was a big drinker, too, you know, but drinking did not interfere with him with work, you know. And he told me that since his grandfather bought silverware, and it turned out there wasn't silver at all. So he said, don't deal with Jews, and have nothing to with them. They are cheats, they are crooks, they are no good, and so on. So it is inherent in them that his parents, his family never wanted to buy from a Jewish store or follow the Jewish people. And he lived under that, the same influence, you know. But little by little, I think he learned the other way, too. He came in contact with Jewish officers, you know. He had high-ranking officers.
Where was he from?
He was from Oklahoma City.
Mm-hmm. When did you get out of the Army?
In December of 45.
Had you seen any fighting? Had you been involved in the Philippines?
I saw action in many islands. I was in the Mariana Islands in Saipan, in the Solomon Islands, and the invasion of the island of Haiti, a large island. And I am a survivor.
Yeah.
Always survived.
Yes. You were not wounded?
I had injuries due to accident, but not
mm-hmm.
actually with an enemy fire.
Mm-hmm.
I was here, as you see, you know,
yes.
My nose broken on one side, but that did not come from enemy action. It came, you know, by getting smacked with something, you know, like a crane or something. I got smacked one time.
What did you do when you got out of the Army?
Well, I returned back to New Britain. I was there for a while. And from all the experiences I had at that particular time, I did not want to be actually a teacher. The bad experience I found out that my family encountered, that practically all people on the Manhattan site were all killed by the Nazis. So I had a very big doubt about the whole thing, you know, about being compassionate and good, and does it pay to be good or so on. I doubt, telling you the truth, I doubted the whole thing. Then I had relatives in Newcastle, Pennsylvania, and I was there. They were in clothing business, something which I knew anyway, and I worked with them for a while. Then I had the idea maybe that I would do it by myself too, which I started. For the first year or two, I hardly did really anything. You know, I was in Cleveland, and I really wasn't anxious.
You were living in Cleveland?
Okay. I had relatives in Cleveland. I didn't live there too long, you know. I still consider that my uncle and aunt always wanted me to come back to New Britain, you know. But I just went around for a while. And then I decided that I would try business. And if that doesn't work, you know, I can always come back and do what I want. Some advised me against trying to be a rabbi or a teacher. You know, you're not going to make any money, you know. It is a poorly paid and hard profession, yeah. So I listened to them, actually. I did try business. Meanwhile, I got married. I met Molly through a relative of ours.
Oh, when did you get married?
Was it in 48, Mom? I met her through a cousin of ours. She said to me one time, you know, when you come to Pittsburgh, he was a salesman. He said, I want you to meet my wife's relative. And being in Pittsburgh, I came to his house out here on Berlin Road, and I did meet her, and it worked out, and we did get married.
And you got married in Pittsburgh?
In Pittsburgh, at the Orthodox synagogue.
Molly was
Molly's,
living in Pittsburgh?
Molly's a native Pittsburgh.
I see, yeah.
She was born native Pittsburgh. Yeah. And I stuck with it for a while. And then, you know, people find out in time about you, you know, and so on. A young rabbi came to, he had a reform temple and a conservative synagogue in Newcastle. A young rabbi came there from New York. His father was a professor at the Yeshiva University. He was rather an orthodox rabbi, but he came into a job like this.
What was his name?
Goliath. He's in New York right now. And it so happened his wife was also a graduate of some Jewish college. She was a teacher, and she used to teach in the Hebrew school down there. One of the president of the shul that I knew about my background a little bit. From, not from me, he knew it from my relatives. And he called me up one time and said, I'd like to talk to you. He says, we need some help. We can't afford to bring in, you know, somebody to a small town and pay living wages or so on. And the rabbi's wife was pregnant and she was sick and they only had for the Kinos class, Tuesday 40, 50 children down there at that time. He says, we need some help and we'd greatly appreciate, you know, if you would help us. At least till the Ravitson will be able to take our job. So
Mr. Huff, tell me the name of the synagogue in Newcastle.
Tiferet Israel Synagogue.
I have a great deal of family in Newcastle. And you say there were 50 in the
year
class?
Yeah, who do you have on it?
My nephew's confirmation class recently was 3. Isn't that awful? Lasley's up in Newcastle, Ron and Jean Lasley. He was president, he's president of the temple there, yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I knew the temple people too, but maybe he wasn't.
Did you know Rabbi Gruen?
I knew him well.
Sure.
I knew Rabbi Gruen very well, I knew his daughter Hannah,
mm-hmm.
And she was
she works here in Pittsburgh, yes.
Yes, I knew very well. So I agreed with him. And I started, I took it over in the afternoon, and through it I became very friendly with this young rabbi. At that time I would say he was in the early 30s.
And what was his name?
Goliath, Israel
Goliath.
His father was the Rosh Yeshiva, actually, from the Talmud department at the Yeshiva University. His father came, so he tried to persuade me, he says, anybody can be in business, he says, but everybody can do. I was very good with the children, and I made a big hit with them. And he was the one, actually, who got me in and do it full time. Now, when I started this clothing business, my cousin was my partner. And actually, he was the one who knew it better than I did, you know. I was sort of little with it. So once I started to do it, and he persuaded me, he says, you'll have better satisfaction, you'll do something, he says, that it is needed here. So finally I did buy it from him, and I became a full-time teacher. Little by little, you know, they used to have 2 services, like Friday evening, and we was not inclined for a second service 8 o'clock in the evening, so the president said, why don't you do it? So he would have a service with the shkia. Little by little, we became like partners. We ran the school together, and we ran his business together.
And you conducted the later service?
I used to conduct the later service.
Were you living in Newcastle
yeah,
then?
Yeah, yeah. And I would use more English prayers, you know, and do it right here, you know, and
mm-hmm.
I would speak to them, and the people, again, believe that I made a big hit with them.
Mrs. Koss said they lived in Newcastle for 16 years.
Yeah. I was there about a year or two, no longer.
Oh.
Than that. And finally, you know, it came to a point that they did not have a rabbi.
They still don't have a rabbi.
Yeah, at that time, for my tenure, and I was busy with the school, you know, to teach all those children. And so I was both. She became the storekeeper, actually, for many years already.
I
was
see.
All in the morning. I would open it up, and I'd sometimes have a funeral, have other things, and I had to go away 12 o'clock. And I never came back till in the evening. Then she was afraid to stay by herself as it was the door, you know.
Yes.
So there was no use hanging on to it, since I gave all my time. My partner, my cousin went to Florida, he wasn't there. So I had to liquidate it. I had offers from Pittsburgh to come here to Pittsburgh. First funded my Israel synagogue to Mali's relatives.
Mm-hmm.
And I visited one time and I talked with Mr. Spitz. He was, you offered me a good job. He offered me living wages and everything. But somehow I still didn't want to give him up at that particular time. There was nobody there but me. At least we should have a rabbi. I wanted an evaluation. I'll tell you how I came to the Hebrew Institute, actually.
First tell me, what kind of store did you have in Newcastle?
It was a men's store.
Men's clothing?
Men's clothing.
Retail?
Okay.
I see. Okay.
Did you know the Freedom was to have hat stores?
Yeah, I know that.
That's my sister-in-law.
They had a store in Slippery Rock.
Yes. Mm-hmm. All over the place.
I don't know the Freedom's here in Pittsburgh. I know I knew
the
ones
in
Slippery Rock. I knew them.
And in Newcastle, you conducted funerals
everything.
And you led services.
I did everything. I
and that was
do.
You did everything a rabbi would do.
I did everything.
Do.
And even when there was a rabbi, I did it too. You know. Because we'd share it, you know.
Yes.
I do one time, or sometime even together, we'd have a funeral. I would have the service in the funeral parlor. Rabbi would have a gravesite or vice versa, you know. So whatever we did was actually, we did run the school together, we ran the rabbinic part of it. I used to have a student congregation all these years. The student congregation would start at 9:30, I would get to 10:30. He would lead the service, and I would read the Torah.
You would read the Torah?
For the adult synagogue. Or vice versa, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So we would share this too.
Mm-hmm.
It became more like a partnership, you know. I was hooked up with his job just as much as he was hooked up with teaching. The only thing was that he only liked small children, beginners.
Mm-hmm.
He never wanted the 12, 13-year-old ones. So the older ones always asked me that I should take him. I should prepare him for Bar Mitzvah and so on. So I've been doing this for many years. But the way I actually got acquainted with Mr. Abrams, not Dr. Abrams, I met Dr. Abrams too, to weddings. When I was in Newcastle, because Dr. Abrams' wife and Molly have cousins in common. They're Mechatonim.
And
not
this
relatives.
Is Dr. Solomon
Abrams,
who is now
his
the director
wife,
of
yeah,
the
Hebrews. Yeah, his wife is a cousin to Molly's cousins. See, she to her mother's side and Mrs. Abrams to her father's side.
And you said you had contact with Mr. Abrams. Who is that?
I had contact with him. I couldn't tell you. It must have been probably in 1960 or so, or 61, the latest. The education committee we had, they decided they wanted an evaluation of the school. Who would evaluate what we are doing? So I figured at that time that the best place I could get an evaluation would be from the Hebrew Institute. They had a good name, you know, in the area. They still have a good name in the area. So I stopped off one time on a Sunday and I met him. We still had the houses where Max and Towers is right now.
Mm-hmm.
So I met him there and I talked with him. So he told me what to do. He told me to make up a list of the textbooks we use in Hebrew school. We had a Sunday school of 10 grades, which was run by volunteers, and I used to teach the confirmation class. And so we made up a list like this here. We didn't have any officers down there. The work was done by volunteers. Our secretaries were volunteers, you know. And the entire Sunday school was about, they were most of them public school teachers, actually. And they prepared themselves for the Jewish subject. Made them up a list and I brought it in.
And this is Mr. Abrams, who is
the father of Dr.
Solomon Abrams.
He was officially the...
And he was the director of the Hebrew Institute?
He was the executive director officially of the Hebrew Institute. And he told me to leave it there and he'll have it looked over, which I think Dr. Abrams looked it over. And somebody else, different other people looked it over. And he told me, he says, in a few weeks, when he used to come practically every Sunday, and it was my mother lived here, my sisters and brothers. So I stopped off one Sunday and he says to me, I'll tell you, you have a better school than we have. Maybe on a small scale, it can be done easier, he says, the way we have a lot of students, a lot of mishmash. He says, whenever you want to come work for us, anytime you want a job, he says, you can come here. We're very glad to have you at the Hebrew Institute. So I influenced him the right way. He says, especially we need a man. He says, most of the teachers are ladies. We need a man teacher. A couple of years later, and I say, I'll think about it, but I really didn't buy it, and I didn't think I would come and ask him for a job or anything. Molly's sister's children went to the Hebrew Institute, Livia in Regent Square, and I don't know, they had a teacher, Mr. Levy, or Louie rather, Louie. He gave up the job, he moved to California, became a principal down there in the school, and they were looking for a man teacher, not a lady teacher. So he called up my sister, Dr. Abrams, and he says, I know, he says, that your brother-in-law is a Hebrew teacher, and he runs a school down there in Newcastle. My father, he says, met him and very well impressed with him. I met him too, but I didn't know him so much. And he asked me to come to Pittsburgh. So he called me at home and he asked me to come. I said, well, I don't know if I can promise you anything. So he says, well, when you're in Pittsburgh, you come and stop over. I'd like to talk to you. They did stop over. Molly was itching to move to Pittsburgh. She wanted to get away. By that time, I didn't know. The story didn't mean anything because I really had it closed most of the time, you know. I wasn't involved with it, you know. And after I met him, he made me a good offer. Molly actually insisted more than anything else that we knew. She said, I'm sick and tired of driving around every Sunday, you know, in bed reference and to come here. And since she had everybody here, nobody there. So we decided we would do it. So he invited me another time to come to a board meeting. At that time, Mr. Finkel was the president of the board of the Hebrew Institute. And that's the way it came about, and I signed a contract with them. I came back to Newcastle. I didn't tell them immediately, you know. I told them a little later, you know, they were in contact with getting a rabbi. And then Mr. Weiner, he was from the luggage company, and you might know him. He was the president of the Franklin Federal Bank at that particular time. It's from that family. And he found out, he was the president of the shul at that particular time, where it is a synagogue. He hid the ceiling, you know. He says, you cannot leave us and can't leave Newcastle. I told him, I say, you know, it is really too late. He says, I know Mr. Abrams and I know Dr. Abrams and I'm going to go there and I'm going to cancel your, and if you're not satisfied, if the show don't pay you enough, I'll put you on the payroll, he said, in the luggage bank. I'll put you on the payroll in the bank. He said, I don't want any Jewish people in Newcastle. The community was getting smaller and smaller. So he really carried on, but I told him one side, I promised, I said, even if I wouldn't sign anything, and they figure with me that I'll be the next school year, I said, then I will be the next school year. He finally realized that I would not give up, you know. And that particular summer, we rented an apartment on Northumberland Street in the month of August, we moved over here, exactly 20 years ago.
Yes.
That would have been
1964. And since then I have been there, which is my 21st school year.
You've been at the Hebrew Institute?
20 years. I finished. And during the time at the Hebrew Institute, for about 10 years, I was the program director for the Old Day Camp, which kept me working 12 months out of the year, only about a week or 2 weeks off. And I used to go in and I had adult education in the evening for a number of years. Finally, it got a little bit too much, you know, and I decided
What else did you teach during the day? What did you teach with the children?
The children, when I started, I used to teach. The program was entirely different than it turned out to be after. I taught the prophets, and I taught Chumash. And I also taught the Hebrew language, but I had a class from older kids. I had 17, 18-year-old ones from high school. And I used to teach them Chumash Tepashi, and I used to teach them also Perek. So I taught them more of the Judaic than language, actually.
Yes.
But then after, when we lost this out to the College of Jewish Studies, because the Hebrew Institute had all the students too, the secondary. When we lost that out, it got too much anyway. I used to come home, the adult education would start around 8:30 or 9, I'd come home 10:30 and it got too much. So the first thing I stopped greeting when I arrived, the adult education. Then we did not have the older children. Then I didn't have to be there till 7:30, you know. I was able to fit like the others. At 6:30, I used to assist also back when I was in the office a little bit.
I want to ask you.
Mystery work I actually began after Mr. Spector used to be the Bar Mitzvah teacher. He had difficulties, especially with girls.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, he didn't believe that the girls should be Bar Mitzvah. And secondly, he became very impatient, you know, very impatient with the students that we had. And Dr. Abrams asked me, I was the only logical one down there, but I started with girls, not to give him any girls. He says, you've been doing it before, so you're accustomed to it. And at the very beginning, the only students I would get is somebody, if you couldn't handle a boy, and a girl. So that was the very beginning, and I still had the same classes. They would be I would make appointments extra with them. They would remain after a class or so on. It'd be 2, 3, 4, and so on. But when it came a time that he completely gave it up, couldn't do it any longer, then I sort of was a natural, you know, to take this over. And it was a different turn because what I did with them, he didn't do with them.
So you took over all of the bar mitzvah and bat mitzvah?
I took over all the bat mitzvah in a class only once a week.
I see.
So at that time we still had 4 days a week Hebrew school.
Mm-hmm.
So I would give 3 days to bar mitzvah work and sometimes go in my class, you know, if any of the teachers wanted me at a car and so on to do something. And on Thursdays I would have a combined class. Maybe C, D, and E, about 3 grades together.
Mm-hmm.
I would have a combined class.
And what did you teach them?
And in
then?
That combined class, I would try to teach them prayer with melody, and dinim, customs and ceremonies, and why we do certain things, and why we don't do any other things. More like in this Judaic field. And every Saturday, we had a very viable student congregation. A the time when the Hebrew Institute had 300-400 students, it wasn't very hard to get on a Saturday 25, 30, or even 40 children,
mm-hmm.
and that went on for a number of years, still about 5 years ago, I would say. And then little by little, it became almost impossible to get more than 35 kids.
And this is at the student
services? It went down
services.
In a natural way to have student services, and we only had it for high holidays, actually. But I would substitute the Shabbat service on Thursdays.
Mm-hmm.
We would make an assembly, and they're still doing that. We still take him in on a Thursday, and I run it on Friday night service or
mm-hmm.
a Saturday morning, abbreviated form, and try mostly in Hebrew, not in English.
I see. We have to stop now.
Yeah.